Hello and welcome to Think Business Futures. I'm your host, Max Tillman. It's one of the cornerstones of the Australian dream, the quarter-acre block, the home among the gum trees. And for many Australians, with interest rates at all-time lows and wages returning to strong levels, it is closer to reality than at any other time in recent memory. The Morrison government on Saturday announced the new home guarantee will allow 10,000 first home buyers to purchase a new home with a deposit of just 5%, while over the next 4 years, the Family Home Guarantee will let 10,000 single-parent families put down a deposit of only 2%. The government will guarantee the other 18% of the deposit. But can we bank upon the housing market with interest rates at uneasily low levels? And what happens when they jump? To break this down today is Professor Harry Schurler, Professor of Finance at the University of Technology, Sydney, and an expert on the housing market, who has been a long-time contributor to Think Business. On Saturday, the federal government announced that 10,000 buyers, home buyers, will soon be able to borrow 98% of the price of a home. So just to start off the conversation, when you hear a press release like that, obviously with your expertise in the market, what are your first thoughts?
Normally, when it comes to policy or governmental policy, I'm always a bit suspicious because politicians tend to be very often very focused on the short-term outcomes and not necessarily into forward-looking or even longer-term policies, especially if these are announcements that come out of the blue. Second, you know, I'm sort of attached to economic school or finance school, and with that, I have a lot of economic thinking in myself. And generally speaking, the more we introduce, call it special policies, often the more we deviate from free markets. And there's a lot of also very good and benefits in free markets. And so with that, generally speaking, I'm always a bit suspicious.
And would you find that with these certain policies, it actually obscures the realities of the property market? Because if the government are from the top down imposing a lot of these policies that do ultimately make it easier for people to enter the market, do you think that in a way it does really obscure the fundamental numbers behind what has allowed the market to get to a point where it is now? And for those who are interested in buying a home who do not qualify to be one of these 10,000 first home buyers, do you think it is going to ultimately make it more difficult for them to get a better appreciation of where they stand?
Just a few maybe things up front. First, the action package, what the government announced, includes three different policies. So there's a first home super saver policy, there's a new home guarantee policy, and a family home guarantee policy. And broadly speaking, they try to make house purchases by first home owners and single parent families more attractive. But now in the bigger picture, there's a lot of things going on in the housing markets. And I think what's going on, if you want to summarize it, is on two ends. There are wealth effects and there are income effects. The wealth effects, they are mainly driven by the low interest rates. So because interest rates are at historic lows, a current cash target rate, I think, is at 10 or 15 basis points. It has come down from a level of 16% in 1990. And so we have had pretty much, if you look at the history of our interest rates since 1990, a steady decline in interest rates, by and large, led to these quite tremendous house price increases that we have observed in the last decade. And at the same time, we have an income effect where people perhaps have more discretionary income, where people have similar salaries to pre-COVID, but post-COVID, lower expenses, but then also mortgages have become more affordable because of these low interest rates. And this is a bit offsetting each other because, you need to spend more money for housing because house prices have increased. But yet, as you have mentioned earlier, people have more powder or money to buy houses. And so one drives the other. And in all of that, things have not changed for the better for everyone. And so people with high income, they may find it easier to buy houses, but a lot of Australians have been left out. And the government sort of tries to do something for two groups. The first home buyers, think of young people who have just been in the workforce for a couple of years. And then also single families, single parent families who have a very hard time to get into the housing market because of relatively low incomes to expenditures.
And particularly with the RBA, I think one of the big points that a lot of people are talking about, and something that is being acknowledged as almost a concrete consistency throughout all this, is interest rates at their historic lows. But if interest rates do rise, then a lot of this plan will start to become unstuck. So do you think that in many ways the government are starting to introduce these packages and these programs in a way to remind the RBA that any change to interest rates would have a catastrophic effect for a lot of Australians? Do you think that they're in some way forcing the RBA against the wall and making sure that despite what happens over the next few months or the next 2 years, economically speaking, that there won't be a change to interest rates?
I mean, it's kind of a little bit, the government wanted definitely supported low interest rates because, the positive effect it has on business activity, and the job creation, but it looks like a little bit like, or it feels a little bit like that it's undoing some of the negative effects of low interest rates. And so the biggest negative effect from a financial well-being aspect to the society of the low interest rates has certainly been the dramatic increase in house prices. And so we've had these growth rates of somewhere between 1% and 4% per month in Sydney and Melbourne, and in the last months. And this was is a consequence of low interest rates, but it comes as a pair with the increased business activity, and also the government has just announced in the last days that the job market looks much better than before, and despite the phasing out of various subsidy programs, the number of people employed has increased. And so this is great, but it comes at the cost of high housing prices, and these new policies aim to undo that. Now, it gets really messy because you're creating an economic stimulus, but you're kind of saying, we want the positive effects on the jobs, but we don't want the positive effects on the house prices. And so the government is currently trying to mix and match, so that it has positives on all ends. And I'm not so sure whether this is very well thought through.
And you don't have to really be an economist to understand that you can't satisfy everyone. Do you think that it is maybe this program is a little bit too leaning to the political as opposed to the pragmatic when it comes to finding a solution to obviously allow, particularly, as you've said, young people who have recently entered the job market, who may have not been as proportionately affected by the pandemic as other people have, particularly those who are in industries where they are able to work from home very effectively. Do you think that it's getting to a point now, particularly with all of these programs running at the same time or some being scaled back, that there will come a moment where a lot of these varying programs that are being used to prop up various parts of the economic cycle at both ends of the cycle are going to make the whole thing fall apart?
The problem is, I think the government is just trying to fix issues as they come along without having a comprehensive strategy. But that is easier said than done. It's not so easy to deal in the current economic environment. And, we've never been there in our lifetime. And so whilst we have always crisis, this crisis is very unique. Every crisis isn't unique, but it's very hard to say what's the perfect fix for that. Now, with the current policies, with these deposit schemes, what we are doing is we're just alleviating the pressure where it hurts most. So I do not think when we say, so let's say 10,000 first home buyers and 10,000 single parent families are eligible. I do not think it is kind of an equal magnitude than what the interest rates declines have done in the first place. So it's probably just alleviating the pressure where it's the largest. And so I think offering these schemes in the big scheme of things probably does not change much of the economic underpinning. So I don't think the scheme will have you know, an impact on house prices, for example. I don't think that the scheme will lead many Australians into the housing markets. Only these 10 or 2 times 10,000 people that are discussed. And so with that, I think it's just one action. And, you know, one could then say, oh, if it's not really economically significant, is that maybe just a little bit also, trying to showcase that you're aware of the pressure on people. It is actually these two groups that have suffered probably the most during the crisis. If you think about single parents that are financially stressed anyway, and then they have their kids at home during lockdown measures and the like, currently most constrained when it comes to travel and other things. And so perhaps it's almost just to show that the government cares, but I'm not sure that it has a huge impact economically.
And do you think that it's dangerous to be giving, particularly for single parents who have, as you said, have suffered a great deal over the pandemic? Do you think it's dangerous to be incentivizing them to take on more debt?
And so I think this is actually the biggest problem in all that. When we talk about 10,000 young people and 10,000 single parents, those are very vulnerable people. And we now need to look at every single case. And what effectively these policies are doing is that they are, first of all, they're focusing on wealth rather than income. And so if you think, you're a single parent family, one of the things you may struggle the most is making daily ends meet. And so you're really struggling to, with your income, to bring food to the table. And now making investment into housing wealth is kind of focusing on the wealth outcome of individuals. And I'm not sure whether it's whether everyone needs to be in housing. So in Australia, we have this long-standing dream that everyone needs to own a house. But I think our society has also changed. And if we look at societies outside Australia, it's totally common for, you know, parts of a population not to own a house and, for example, to live renting, in particular in societies where we have a supernation scheme. And so this is exactly where Australia has changed. We have built up a supernation scheme, which is many trillions of dollars, and it's supposed to help us through the retirement phase. And this is exactly what housing did in the olden days. But since now we have a new retirement underpinning, it's not necessary for everyone to own houses. And you know, also there are alternative ways to get into housing if so one desires. For example, one can invest in real estate investment trusts through superannuation and other. But now what we're doing is we're kind of creating incentives for people to own houses. And, you know, this is not a bad idea, generally speaking. But the people who are going into housing, especially the low-income people, they allocate a large proportion of their wealth into one asset class. And, you know, now from a finance perspective, this is very risky. In the past, it has worked because housing prices have increased over 30 plus years. But it has increased because of interest declines. And now we are at the zero mark. There's a lower zero bound. Interest rates rarely become negative. It's very unlikely that the RBA can decrease the interest rates further and continue to inflate housing prices for another 30 years. And, house prices may plateau and not move anymore, but they can also go the other way around and decline. And if then, especially low income people are overexposed to markets, that would suffer quite a bit from interest rate increases when we actually do not actually help them. We do the opposite. We cause much more financial distress than we would otherwise. And so with that, we need to really consider that scenario: interest rates going up, house prices going down. Do we really help these people, or would there be better ways to help them? And, you know, I could think of many better ways to do that. For example, to have lower income taxes for these people, to just make them having more funds available to meet their daily needs.
And particularly with the 2% deposit, I think a lot of the sort of public discourse about this that is being generated, mainly obviously by the government, is that it is a very modest deposit. But ultimately, if you're paying a 2% deposit, that means you will be mortgaging out 98% of the home, which is a long-term financial decision as opposed to a very short-term fix. So do you think ultimately it's putting these people in a worse-off position by essentially making them pay off 98% of that home's value as mortgage repayments?
That's correct. You still need to repay everything, so the whole amount, and you're not really gaining from that. Now, in the past, what has happened because of these huge capital gains that homeowners have experienced, they were usually able to repay mortgages well before the 30-year maturity. But, you know, if we now go through these scenarios where house prices do not further increase, then people will need to repay the loans over 30 years. And that is basically a lifetime, a work lifetime of individuals. And I think whether you have this deposit guarantee scheme or not from the government, it doesn't make the repayment easier. But it does make it easier for people to get into housing. Basically expose themselves to potential troubles. The other thing is, despite the deposit insurance that the government offers, the people still have to go through all the traditional bank requirements. So they need to fill out a loan application, they need to be approved, although the approval is now more likely because obviously the government guarantees the gap between the loan-to-value ratio under 2%, that's 98%, and the 80%, that's the 18% difference. Now, I should also mention similar schemes existed before that. For example, in Western Australia, they have a system that's sort of broadly labeled Keystart, and where the Western Australian government also offers a mortgage insurance program or loans at very high loan-to-value ratios. And from memory, it was available to everyone, not only first home buyers or single parent families, but broadly speaking, low income people. So with that, the government is bringing up a policy that is has been used before in Western Australia. But I'm not sure that it really helps people.
And is the economy healthy enough and robust enough to actually give these people the prospect of being able to find consistent work over, with a lot of these loans, it'll be 35-odd year terms on these. Do you think people will actually have the confidence in the economy, not as economists, but just as regular working Australians who may not understand the intricacies of the economy and the way that it works? Do you think people will actually have enough confidence to take up the government's offer? Because a 2% deposit sounds fantastic, but most people will be looking over the prospective next 10, 15 years of their life, particularly if they're a single parent, where that has probably always been something they've been concerned with, regardless of the property market. Do you think that people will actually have enough confidence in the economy to take up this offer? Because ultimately, if the rates go up, then a lot of these borrowers will be forced to sell their homes. So do you think people actually do have enough confidence in the economy and in the plan and the system that Josh Frydenberg and Scott Morrison have installed to get us not only out of COVID, but then back on the right track for prosperity many years in the future? Do you think there is confidence there?
Well, I definitely would say there's confidence in the market. The outcome post-COVID, everybody's surprised how well we are doing. But I think the confidence does not necessarily help us because we need to be objective and not over-optimistic going forward, especially if we talk about people's financial situation, the lifetime savings, and in particular, if you talk about low-income Australians that are, the most vulnerable of our society. And I just want to if you do a bit of math in the back of our head, usually people would save 1-3 years of their, call it savings for a home deposit. And, if then people in, say, 2 or 3 years have managed to save 2%, question is, can they then over 30 years, because 1 minus the 2% would be 98% over 30 years, we talk about 3.3% of a house value. Can they manage then to repay 3.3% each and every year, which, you know, they are only able to save 2% at the beginning. And so, you know, if you then project how long it took them to come up with a deposit, it's often very unlikely that they will be able to make a greater annual repayment. So basically, if you on the back of our head calculate how long it took people to make a deposit payment of 2% and then relate that to a 30-year repayment period on mortgage loans for the remaining 98%, it's very unlikely for them to probably meet these expectations. And I should also point out, next to rising interest rates in the medium to long term, there's a second danger. And it's possible that our economy is changing and already has changed with the digital age. So there's, I would say, a larger likelihood of people to work under fixed term contracts, or even in the shared economy under arrangements where they, for example, become, you know, if you think of Uber drivers, self-employed, effectively self-employed, and working on a part-time basis. And so the work models going forward might be very, very different to the work models in the past. And so they may not be so aligned with making very periodic mortgage repayments as the work models have been in the past. And so just, that could be another stress going forward.
And one more question before I let you go. But you've already spoken about how the Australian dream of owning a home essentially forces many people into purchasing. But is there ultimately another alternative to this, beefing up and making the tenancy laws in Australia a little bit more equitable and allowing people to see the rental market as a fair and equitable alternative to purchasing their own home? Do you think that is maybe something that the government have essentially ignored? Obviously, there were moratoriums on rental payments, and that was essentially a stopgap during the worst time of the COVID lockdown. But going forward, is it important to essentially strengthen those policies and allow people to view renting as not just a short-term solution before they can accrue enough savings to purchase?
Certainly. So if we compare Australia with overseas economies, and when it comes to renting, people want to live in a rental home like if it was their own home. So we talk about long-term leases. And, you know, in Europe, in particular, the Scandinavian countries, Germany, you have large real estate, called real estate landlords that own, say, hundreds of thousands to millions of units. And that in Australia does not exist. So if in Australia, if you look at the number of properties investors hold, they usually hold up to 5 properties. It's interesting that coincides with the number of states in this country. It coincides with the number of states of Australia, because often the investors, they hold these properties in different states. And what's underpinning all that is the land tax, how land tax is arranged in Australia. But it's a state-based law, and also it disadvantages large property owners from small property, basically the moms and dads owners. These frictions in the market have been acknowledged. New South Wales, for example, is currently thinking about changing, replacing the stamp duty with a large-based, broadly-based land tax. It's under discussion. And it's my understanding that may fix some of the issues that are creating the shortage of long-term housing supply for rental markets in Australia.
Well, should we be banking on our own home among the gum trees, or should tenancy laws be strengthened to dispel the myth that home ownership is a rite of passage for an ordinary Aussie? As Professor Schirler makes clear, a rise in interest rates would have a severe effect upon many of the country's most vulnerable people, particularly with job security still uncertain going into the future. Thanks for listening to today's show. Think Business Futures, as always, is produced at the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. A thank you to the UTS Business School and our national broadcast partner, the Community Radio Network. Catch all our shows online wherever you get your podcasts. I'll see you again next week.